tonight on Arena. Brendan the Galley on his documentary on grief and Donald Teskey on his exhibition Away from the Hill. The T.G. Cahir documentary series Mishnock returns this Wednesday and kicks off with a very special authored film on grief from the renowned dancer Brendan the Galley. In Cua, Brendan charts his own journey through loss following the sudden death of his partner Declan in 2021. Through the documentary, Brendan meets people making their own way through grief and explores the very particular way in which we deal with the death of a loved one in this country. He also looks at very particular experiences of people losing a partner as a gay person and asks whether Irish society treats loss in homosexual partnerships differently to loss in heterosexual relationships. I'm delighted to be joined by Brendan the Galley in studio. First off, Brendan, my condolences on the death of your partner, Declan. It's over 3 years ago now, but in the documentary, you recall a very sudden death.
Yeah, it was, like you said, over 3 years ago. So this May 29th, it'll be 4 years. And it was really unexpected, and that was, it's always difficult, but it was, I always laugh about Declan because he was quite the hard liver, but he also managed to be healthy. Never got a dose the way I would get doses regularly. He was kind of very naturally very fit and very able, and it just unfortunately he was, he died of an aortic dissection. And my sister, who's a doctor, heard this and she just knew at that point that that was it. Now, he did get through the surgery. It was surprising that he got as far as James's from Mullingar because he had just lost his father not too long beforehand and kind of was saying goodbye, I suppose, to the family home in a way. So he spent quite a bit of time there, and it was during COVID, so it was a nice place to be. But my sister had her suspicions that he might have had something quite rare, a connective tissue condition, and the surgeon, when he spoke to me about treating the condition, that it was disappearing in his fingers like tissue. So it was never diagnosed, and there was it wasn't expected at all, and it was just incredibly tough, you know, really, really hard, because even though Declan's father Henry was this incredibly open-minded, friendly man, you know, he was quite crefa, as we say in Irish, he was quite holy. And Declan decided, you know, with his family, that maybe Henry was too old to just let him know about this, although people are surprisingly intuitive. And I had a great time with Henry and Declan down in Mullingar while he was alive. But Declan really looked after him towards the end. And it was just after that that you felt really the sense of, I can talk so openly about it. And I remember once I was on Shal Laidh Dath Thaidh on T.G. Cahir, and I spoke openly about it and mentioned his name and all that. And it wasn't long after that that Declan died. And I felt, and this is terrible, but that there was a superstition that had I not opened my mouth and spoken so haughtily about, you know, this great relationship that we had, that he'd still be around. Obviously, that's just, you know, blarney, but...
You did have a great relationship, you and Declan. You were both artistic and in the arts, even though very different disciplines. You a dancer, he was a photographer.
Yeah.
But you said he fulfilled all your needs because he was a support to you as an artist, as well as living together and being able to work most of the time in each other's presence.
Absolutely. He was the most generous person when it came to other people's talents and abilities. And he had so little confidence himself, yet everybody recognised his brilliance as a photographer. And what he did was he championed all of us that had, you know, that needed that kind of like little bit of a push to do, to realise our dreams in terms of our artistic pursuits. And he never did it with any sort of jealousy. Like I'd be immediately jealous of somebody who's particularly good at something. But he was just, he just loved that his friends were good at stuff. and he just really encouraged them. And but when it came, the thing about Declan and me working together was he was able to capture in my dance work what I couldn't manage to get across on a video. So when you're trying to, with Arts Council applications or whatever, I always felt the video just didn't do it justice because there was something in it that I could see that wasn't really popping out of the, you know, the poor quality video that I was making, but his photographs captured that. Even though
they
were still.
And you see those in the documentary where you're elevated. They're wonderful, caught in time and space.
Absolutely. But it was more the expression within, the real nuanced expression within the bodies. And he was able to choose a photograph. Not all photographers are able to pick a photograph that a dancer would like, but Declan always knew, even though he didn't know what we valued, you know, and I would like, but as well as that, it was just sitting, having that pint of Guinness and then talking about the project and I wanted to be avant-garde and he wanted me to encourage me to not worry about what the expectations were because I work in the traditional arts, but I always felt like the pieces I wanted to make, you know, managed to be other things and do other things rather than just entertain. And he gave me the confidence because he recognised in it and he really encouraged. And that was his great talent. It was just a people person. And he also, like those who felt disenfranchised or marginalised, he kind of gathered them in and he made a world for them to exist in. And
I'm sure as an artist coming from the traditional arts and you were breaking down barriers, you are avant-garde. That is what you do in your work. So it must be great, wonderful and much needed to have that kind of support.
Oh, absolutely. And I suppose that was one of the really very devastating things that I've experienced immediately afterwards was that question, would I be able to continue without him? And it was during COVID and I was asked to do a project in the at the Errigal Arts Festival, which had to be outside because there were restrictions. So we did it on Ilanchari, Tory Island. And I think he just remained with me. So thankfully, I was able to go. I felt a sense of distraction that was really, really, really quite liberating in at that moment because it was still very, very raw. It was only a couple of months afterwards. And then I just felt like, you know what, I think I need to do it. And I think I need to do it for me to be healthy in physically healthy and mentally healthy, but also to remember Declan and do exactly what he wanted me to continue doing.
And then when T.G. Cahir approached you about the Mishnock series and asked you to lead this documentary, to author this documentary on grief, were you worried about doing it?
I really didn't know if it was the right thing for me to do. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, really soul searching. I was afraid that if I did it, that it might be interpreted as, or I would hate for it to be commodifying in some way that story. But I also felt that there was a lot of things that I needed to say, a lot of things that I learned. And I knew there was a lot of people like me that probably would benefit from this, the support or the recognition of what a person goes through on different accounts. So it might be initially you're really supported, people come in. Like I said to the Sinead, the researcher, like the dancers that I work with, they moved into my house what felt like a ridiculous amount of time considering that they had their own lives. But what does happen is people have to get on with their own lives and they have to face their own challenges. And it's really hard immediately after that because you're afraid of troubling people by even saying anything about it. That was something I thought that was worth interrogating, I suppose. And then there was the experience of being gay and that thing of losing, you know, your significant other, your lover, and that's all you had. It's not as if you had, you know, a load of children or anything like that. Now, you still have your immediate family. So that was something I thought that was worth exploring.
Now, let's play a clip from the documentary. In the documentary, you go around the country, really, and talk to people. And in Galway, you found this support group for people who are bereaved. They meet in the Aeon restaurant in Galway. In this clip, you talk to, it's called the Grief Cafe in Galway. It just turns into the Grief Cafe for a number of hours in the week. Jerry Slevin, Paula Lawless, and Tina Lawless talk about their experience of loss.
I remember people start saying, Gerard, you've got to move on. And for some reason, that started to annoy me, as if like I was like stuck. But looking back, I used to, why would people say that to you? Why would anybody say you've got to move on? How does anybody
think
move on?
They experienced it, or do you think they're so uncomfortable with emotion?
100%.
And afraid you're going to start crying.
Yeah.
So how
yes.
How am I going to cope? Yeah. He breaks down and cries. What do I say?
What do I do?
How do I deal with it? Instead of saying it's their agony.
Yeah.
I have to get over it.
Yeah.
I think they don't know what to say, so we tend to fill in the gaps in Ireland.
There we go. That's a clip there from the Grief Cafe from the documentary. Cua, what does Cua mean?
So in the, I would...
pronounce it wrong?
You pronounced it the Kaijan. We say Cui at home, and it was the word that the production team were using. And of course it does mean grief, but I had used it all my life as the sense of longing for something that was absent in your life. So it makes absolute sense. But I don't think I used it growing up in that context, although maybe I wasn't in that. I didn't have that experience. I mean, thankfully, I didn't experience that sort of loss really that significantly until Declan. But it's a very appropriate word, because it really spoke to the experience I was having.
Now, the women there were saying that they hated that term, move on. But you do at one stage go, you know, is there a way to the other side of grief?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, you know, it's too painful and too raw to be in it. And you feel, not that you want to be, but you feel that there might be something beyond grief.
Yeah, like a lot of things, I kind of, I suppose, make sense of these things through my arts practice. And one of the things that I started to work on was a piece that I named after Declan, Declaned, because that's when he lived in London. They never really knew how to say his name properly. But it also, he did create this world. And I worked with it. I am working with it, because it hasn't come to fruition yet, with David Downs, who's a composer who also experienced something very, very similar. And it's been very cathartic. And I think at the heart of this piece of dance work or theatrical work is an Ilachracht, the pilgrimage. And I wouldn't be religious or even spiritual, but it was that sense of I was able to move on by actually physically moving forward, by getting in the car and going somewhere else, by getting out of the house. And that was a big part of what I am. That became something that I explored, not only within the artwork, but also in every aspect of my life. And then the word for relief, to get that relief, but the word in Irish is fuishu, and that became a big part of the text that myself and David worked with, which is fuishu is relief, but in Irish it feels to me that it's something more than relief. There's something you feel almost as if you're better than you would have been. It's really hard to explain, and that's something that I just really was, I want to get to the other side, understand it better, realise that I got some strength out of it, that it will always be with me, but I can cope with it in a different way. That has added something to my experience that I can, I don't know, that thing that doesn't kill you makes you stronger, sort of a thing.
You talked to another artist, Eilish Nigivna, the wonderful writer, and she talked about Beau, her husband, who died. And you asked her as a novelist how to describe how she felt about her work in the aftermath of losing her partner.
Your purple bus, August Beamer, Lekeila Beamer, posted that truck a plane over Dagen. Agus bí cúpla comisiún a gom con úrscéil tá scríb just near hasti gom ní raib fáin ar bí horam bé hig play le fiction chiap mé go raibh sé sáis postúl bé hig ma hiún sin ag jenna sú scéil tá pwy dhína nach wil án a gop ráid leis an ráid seo bí thrais tórlú I mean an ráid is smó agus I sú fósí síl am a horlín da aina agus bí me hana féin tosna ag scríb fwy sin nor bhí sé san ospidéal agus lean mé a raig. Agus siadam gur carraig sé sin go mór. An sin tréis bliain nó gó hosi mé cur crut ar an stif sin ar fad agus do cruthi mé leabhar as. Agus de carraig sé sin freisin mar is dólam nor bhí tú ag cruthú ruair d'éigean bíonairt díorú isteach air.
So Eilish na Guivna there. Again, she had difficulties at the beginning about going back to the novels. She said Páistiúil, I think childish in some ways. And then she just started writing about her partner.
Absolutely. I think that maybe is a really kind of good way of just really engage with it head on in the way that you know.
You talk then towards the end of the documentary to Bill Foley, who lost his partner, Christopher, a gay couple, which, of course, you can relate to being Declan being your partner. What did he say about the differences for a gay person as opposed to somebody in a heterosexual relationship? I know there are children, but, you know, that supportive community, is it different?
Well, again, it was very interesting to have that chat with somebody who had the experience. His seemed slightly different from my own. It had been a lot of time had passed. I was, I suppose, a little bit envious because he seemed to have come through the other end. But it was there were certainly resonances, and for me it was about the absence of somebody else who is an immediate member of your family other than your siblings or your mother or father. And I just felt like, I don't think people understand that that is your entire family. It is like wiping out your spouse and the rest and the children. And that's the thing that really got me. And also, and people are incredible, but like just being afraid that people didn't see you as a family, that that really was with me. Whether that's the case or not, I don't know. But it was something that kind of sort of infuriated me at times, that I was afraid that people wouldn't see it, that this is what's happened. Like, this is all I had, in a way, in terms of that significant other, that was your everything, your absolute everything. Because I've incredible families, six other siblings, but they've got their partners, they've got their children. I'm the only one without children. So it was, just being afraid that society doesn't see or value your relationships quite the same way.
And Prenthana, how do you keep Declan present in your life? Is it through memory, or do you feel him within you? Or can I say that? I don't know how you feel about it now.
It's very hard to make sense of, because there are times I feel like, did he ever exist? And there are times I hear something and I'll say, geez, I better tell Declan that. Oh, guess who I met? It was a friend of Declan's. So these things are, and then you just find yourself stuck to the ground thinking, oh my God, he's just, you know, it's just really incredibly hard. But I think there's something that came out of the documentary where I felt that the experience of the people that I spoke to, and this is not a hard and fast rule, but there was something about the 3 year. And if that was my only takeaway, that was enough for me, that there was that sense that you were ready for the next chapter. But there was a time in I needed to put away some of the Declan stuff. I had a shrine, and it was just breaking my heart all the time. So I kind of packed that up and I said, I'll save this and I'll look at it another time. All those cards that I got, those the photograph that was on the coffin, all these things. But I really, really felt I needed to find the strength or some way to get on with things anyway, just for my own good. But I think the one thing I felt immediately afterwards, when I was having a good moment, that I felt he was sitting on my shoulder and he was saying to me, just you have to have all these adventures now for both of us. That's kind of the way I saw it.
That's a wonderful way to end our chat. Brendan, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about Declan. Brendan's film, Mishnach Cui or Cua, will be broadcast this Wednesday evening at 9:30 on TG Cahar and, of course, on the TG Cahar player. Brendan, thank you.
Thanks.
Kevin Scally and Brendan Foreman shaped the Abbey Theatre's visual identity from the early 1970s to the late 1980s. As in-house graphic designers, they brought fresh approaches to theatre posters, reflecting artistic trends and the evolving cultural landscape of Dublin. Kevin joined the Abbey in 1972, collaborating with directors to visually translate productions. Brendan took over in 1979, building on Kevin's legacy with bold, distinctive designs. I'm delighted to be joined by Brendan Foreman in studio with me and Kevin Scally on the line to tell us about Poster Boys, an exhibition of their work at the National Print Museum. You're both very welcome. Kevin, your interest in graphics grew out of your own love of theatre.
It did, yeah. I mean, I did a fair bit of acting in those before joining the Abbey. And I think that was one of the reasons I actually got the job, because probably was one of the few, if not only, candidates who produced a theatre poster or two. So I think that was one of the key factors. But yeah, I mean, my interest is in theatre probably as much or more than graphic design.
And who was the artistic director in the Abbey then?
Well, actually, when I went in, it was an ex-RTE person, Lelia Doolan.
Oh, yes.
Might remember from that particular period. There was a bit of controversy about Lelia's departure from RTE, but she was in the Abbey for a very short period after I joined. And I think then Tomás McConnell took over at that point. I don't remember anybody else during the period when I was there.
All right. And then, Brendan, when you joined, you came from advertising rather than from the arts as such.
That's right, yes. Although I was always designing posters for friends, either in the theatre, I was designing for music events, for Project Arts Centre. I had a huge interest in poster design. I'd even see Kevin's Abbey Theatre posters around the pubs, and I was always impressed and fascinated by them. And when I got the opportunity to go in and meet Joe Dowling, I was thrilled. I mean, it didn't matter. I was going to earn less than advertising. I was more interested in designing posters and theatre posters. That was what I was interested in.
So there was a graphics department then, Kevin. Had you established that to say that you were getting somebody else in?
No. I had left, actually, at that point. That was about the time when I left. The graphics department usually consisted of one person. There was a design department, which was somewhat bigger. It had a few theatre designers, scenic artists, and people like that. And that would probably about six or seven people. I can't exactly remember. But the graphic design, just one person.
Right. And we thought we'd talk about some of the images you created that are in the exhibition. So Brian Friel is somebody whose work you worked on posters to advertise a play called Volunteers, Kevin.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, actually, Brian Friel was in a very productive period over that decade and into the next. A lot of his good work was, I think, the Freedom of the City was just before I joined. But Volunteers, yeah, about a couple of actually prisoners in Dublin who volunteered to work on the Wood Quay site in the archaeological site, the Viking Dig, in order to probably just get out for the day. But they didn't make themselves popular with their compatriots. And it's a kind of a double thing. There's sort of past history, present history and future history in true Brian Friel form. There's a lot going on in the play.
So you would have talked to the director about his vision for this. It's a very realist poster. Would that be fair to say?
That's true. Yeah, it is. It's semi-photographic, really. You talk to the. I think one important point that often isn't made or doesn't come out is that in the 1970s and into the 1980s, when Brendan was there, there were no computers doing graphics. So every single thing had to be done by hand, including all of the. If you do a visual to show to the director, that has to be, you know, scratched out either in the back of an envelope or something more finished. But you don't have a computer to help you do it, as people today have. You know, every single. You can do a poster on a mobile phone or an iPhone today using the software and then produce a PDF and send it to the printer. Back then, it was a painful and long process.
So was a photograph the basis of this, or did you?
No, you had to go looking. I mean, you see today you have the internet at your disposal. If you wanted a photograph of a couple of, archaeologists or something, you just go onto the internet, put in archaeologists, and or you ask an AI engine, and it'll come back with as many images as you need. But you had to do the hard work there. You had to go and look at books, newspaper, go to the library, all of those kinds of things, hard research.
Now, Brendan, I've got an image here of The Field by John B. Keane, and it's starring Neil Tobin. And I guess you, as the designer, knew that Neil Tobin as the Bull McCabe was the occasion, really. So his face is lit large over an image of The Field.
Yeah, well, it isn't just The Field, it's also Electric Pylons. And that was a photo that the set designer had got in his research. And when you'd be designing a poster, you'd be talking to the director and the set designer and what the production was about and the spirit of it. And I took that photograph and made a large print and then a white area over it, and then I airbrushed the illustration. I had done a small sketch initially. I very like what the finished job, and that's what I showed to the director. There was no brief to include Niall Tobin or anything like that. It was just something that struck me. And one of his photographs had that striking kind of glaring look. And then I translated it into the illustration.
Yes, Ben Barnes would have been, I think, the director.
He was the director, yes.
At that stage. And then there's this wonderful one that you did, Kevin, of a Tom Stoppard play. It's called Travesties. And it's set in Zurich, is that right? The play is in 1917, when Joyce would have been there.
That's right. That's right, it is. Yeah. In fact, with Joyce, Lennon, and an absurdist artist called Tristan Zara. So Tom Stoppard was aware of the fact that they were all in Zurich at the time, but there's no evidence that they ever met, so he just took that and ran with it. So the poster itself is a pastiche of a French poster from the late 19th century by Toulouse-Lautrec. And it's a pastiche of an image, which is itself a pastiche of the events in the play. It was enjoyable to do it.
I can imagine they must have been fun to do, especially with
because you can see
Lennon very clearly and the other artists just behind Joyce.
Zara. Nobody knows what Zara. Nobody would recognize Zara. You'd recognize Lennon and Joyce, but you wouldn't recognize. All right, that's why he's hiding behind the other two.
And there's another one here then, Brendan, of the Patrick Pearse Motel. So this is a Hugh Leonard play.
That's right, yes. And
looks like the Bates Motel.
Yeah, well, it's a comedy, and every room in the motel has a name after an Irish revolutionary hero. And it's kind of Leonard's kind of parody of that. Re-looking at 1916 and Pearse himself. And it's a bit of a farce as well. But another feature about the posters, and the same with Travesties, is that they were silk screen and the colours are very intense. And I'm surprised when I see them now in the exhibition how strong the colours still appear after all these years. It's just silk screen is such a great medium for theatre posters. And a lot of the posters that are on the exhibition are done silk screen as well.
And now, Kevin was saying that you have to do so much work back then because you didn't have the internet and access to. But surely other theatres must have been jealous of the resources at the Abbey, were they?
Every theatre, all the resources the theatre had, I suppose, because everything was in-house, from set design, costume, even the Abbey players. And there were other theatre companies doing posters, but they may not have had the same kind of resources, as you say, to devote so much work. But I mean, also the Abbey Theatre was doing a lot of productions at that time. I would have done 9 posters for the Abbey in 81 and something like 18 posters for the Peacock. The Peacock had its own administrator. Joe Dowling started as, actually, artistic director of the Peacock. But and they had a lot of lunchtime shows and shorter run shows, and every one of them had to have a poster.
But Brendan, that seems very grand. But I think your accommodation in the Abbey was not very grand.
Yes, that's true. Yes, that's very true. It was a converted staff toilet, and my desk was over a toilet bowl that still functioned. But I had a Repro Master camera, which would help me to complete the artwork, the finished art for the posters. But they did move me to another room under the stage, beside a dressing room, where I could hear the actors at night preparing. And but I left the camera where it was, and I used it.
And Kevin, how aware would you keep yourself of the various artistic movements, either around town or in the art world, in terms of doing, I don't know, pop style posters or all the various techniques you would have used? I was looking at one of the Brendan Behan posters that you did, which was very orange and very bright and slightly techno.
Well, you're aware of art movements, of course, and obviously depending on the production and the way the play is going to be done and the context for it and the period in which it's set, all of that. I mean, for example, you can do a Shakespeare play, and they have been done in pretty much any period in history. So where are you going to go looking for the artistic style for that? I mean, it could be medieval, it could be 19th century, 20th century, modernist era, and then you have to go and do your research, I think. So you can be aware of them. I mean, in your head you have a sort of a map of artistic styles, but when you need to go and get references, you've got to be very specific, so you've got to go and dig them out. And you don't, as I was saying, have the internet to help you on that search. You know, you do it the hard way.
Yes, I'm looking at some of Brendan, some of your posters for Bernard Farrell's plays, which would have been comedies as such, and they're very bright and bold.
That's right, yeah. All the Way Back and Canaries, yes. Again, they would be, they were very different. You'd always try and make a poster suit the production, so the style would be different. And I don't know where I got the idea from Canaries from. It just seemed appropriate, you know, a kind of an Irish family and friends on holiday in Canaries, and it's a bit of a farce again. And that's just the way I treated it, yes.
Yes, they're all kind of in wicker cages, I think, so things mustn't be going great.
They're trapped in a way, yes. They think they're free on holiday, but they're trapped.
So, Kevin, how has the printing process then changed over time?
I mean, incredibly, it has changed. I mean, it's a whole other world. I mean, you, as I said, you can take out your mobile phone, design something in full colour, save it as a PDF and send it to a printer who just uses a single machine that will print it in four colour process, for example, print it, fold it, you know, cut it, do whatever is required in you know, a matter of minutes. Back then, I mean, you know, the artwork was all done in individual colours, had to be sort of broken up. So you do a piece of artwork for each colour in the job. They couldn't, theatre, even the Abbey with all its resources, couldn't afford to do four colour process in the 70s. Those were expensive, and you did long runs, and most of the Abbey posters were quite short ones. So you're talking about, and when we were doing it in the 70s, and I'm sure in the 80s, you know, a process or a technique and technology that goes back hundreds of years, anything that's happened really to today's tech really comes in with the Apple Macintosh in 1984, the development of color screens for that, PostScript printing, and then digitizing the ability to digitize images, which obviously affects photography as well. It's why you can do everything with your smartphone, because it can take four color pictures, it can send images around the world, it can, you know, work on the internet, it does all of these things.
And do you just go with the technological innovations, or do you miss that kind of tactile quality and experience you had?
If you're doing something today, you just go with the technology. That's the reality, because it's a question of speed and economics. If you want to kind of rediscover, as it were, those earlier technologies, you have to go and, you know, go back and do it the hard way. And there's a huge qualities that you get from, Brendan mentioned screen printing, like the putting on thick paint through a screen, but there's also qualities you get with old-fashioned letterpress printing with metal type that you will not achieve with a digital four-color process today. You get different effects, but you don't get those. So I suppose everything again comes down to what are you trying to get to in the end. So the designer always has a vision of what they see.
What do you think, Brendan? Are you nostalgic for some of the creativity then and the kind of tactile nature of the process?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, you were restricted in a way, but because of the restrictions, you had to find solutions. And again, at the exhibition, I'm surprised at the variation and the quality to some of the stuff, especially the way it's presented. But it was nice talking about older print forms. It was nice for the National Print Museum to ask us to design our own response poster, which they printed.
Yes, tell us about that.
They printed on their, it must be 70 years old, a Van der Cook number 4 letterpress. Mary there was the printer. And I mean, even preparing the artwork for it brought me back to the way I used to prepare artwork, finished art, layers and so on. But I had to do it on my Apple Mac. It's funny. But
and then you and handed that process over then to one of these old printing presses.
Mary got the plates made and she printed them in the museum. And there's 75 copies each and they're all signed. Each by, Kevin designed his poster and I designed my own. So it was nice to go back.
And what did you put on the poster?
My poster actually was a distorted kind of representation of the Abbey Theatre logo, mainly because I just associate it so strongly with my time there. And anytime I see it, I go back to the 80s. That's it. It's pure and simple. And Kevin's one is more interesting because he recreated where he did the artwork and he's got his kind of little Pantone colour and, well, he should talk.
Yes, Kevin, do you tell us what you were thinking when you created your poster?
It has a reverberation for RTE because a memory of sitting out in County Meath, actually it was at the time, at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And RTE didn't actually broadcast the radio in the middle of the night. In fact, every radio station that you could get out there stopped dead. So you're sitting there listening to the BBC World Service. So it was sort of what's happening in Bulgaria or sort of Nigeria at 3 or 4 in the morning. But to me, that was almost, that was the kind of thing that I was trying to evoke and that was so memorable about it, is when you're sitting on your own sort of trying to finish and you've got a deadline with a printer at 9 o'clock the following morning. So it's the kind of making the thing. It's the actual making of it, which is interesting. What I was talking about, the kind of traditional artwork.
There's a lovely quote from Frank McGuinness at the exhibition. He says there is a skill to creating a good poster for a play. It shouldn't say too little, and above all, it should not say too much. The image can guide you subtly to the heart of the text and show you some secrets behind the writing. Would you agree with that? And could you give us an example of that, maybe, Brendan?
A poster that does that.
Yes, or a poster you feel you created yourself. I'd
say Sive, my poster for Sive, which...
By John McKean, of course.
By John McKean, yeah. And I think that was directed by Ben Barnes too. But I mean, I tried to get something of the mood of the play, and it was just in colours and illustration and type as well. Type actually added to the... expression or the mood, and that was hand-drawn. I hand-drew that. But it was my smaller sketch. I just did it very quickly, the colours and everything, and then I just translated that to large artwork. But, I mean, that would be an example of kind of not just advertising the play, but creating, sharing something of the spirit of the production as well.
What about you, Kevin? Do you agree with what Frank McGuinness says?
Yes, but for slightly different. I'm just reminded of a quote from Stanley Kubrick when people kept asking him what the end of 2001 meant. And he eventually decided to explain it. But he said, under these circumstances, I'm explaining it. He said, when you actually tell people what something meant, it always sounds a bit silly, or a bit often perhaps childish, or a bit obvious. Whereas when you leave ambiguity in it, it sort of works better. And I think perhaps that's what you're trying to do, both in the production of the play, in the set design, the poster, and every part of it. You leave elements of ambiguity, and people can work it out for themselves. You can take more than one meaning out of it. So that's probably, I think that's probably the best way to leave it, really. I think Kubrick was right on that. And Frank McGuinness is right on what he said.
Leave a space to let us in, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Kevin Skelly exactly. And Brendan Foreman, thank you so much for talking to us tonight. Poster Boys is at the National Print Museum in Dublin until the end of the year, and entry is free. Details on nationalprintmuseum.ie. A new exhibition of works by the internationally renowned Irish artist Donald Teskey will open at the Claire Morris Gallery on March the 22nd. The exhibition, called A Wave from the Hill, is inspired by a poem by the Lebanese-American writer, poet and visual artist Cahil Gibran called Fear. It talks about the river's fear when it's under apprehension of entering the ocean. Well, I'm delighted to talk to Donald about his latest exhibition, and we'll be tweeting four of the images on @RT_arena, that's on Instagram, or @RT_arena on Twitter. Donald, maybe you'll bring us into that Cahil Gibran poem and how it either affected you and how it explains how you feel about the landscape, that idea of the river and the ocean. Oh, I think we've just... Poem. Oh, hey, there. Oh, sorry, Donald. I thought you were cut off. Sorry.
Okay, yeah. Hello, Kay.
Hello, it's so nice to talk to you.
I came across this poem a little while ago, and it really struck me. Obviously, it talks about change and transition and the fear of change and the way really... when faced with it, there is no going back. So I think, in my own situation, I'm living over in the west of Ireland. It's a big change for me because I've moved from Dublin. And it kind of became that idea of change and embracing a whole new sort of way of looking at the landscape by living in the landscape became... central to this body of work, and also bringing together, originated initially in Dublin.
Sorry, Donald, your line is breaking up ever so slightly. We'll continue for a second. You're okay. You're okay.
Yeah. Okay. It's lovely where I am living over, looking over an estuary which sees a river flowing into a sea and the sea flowing into the ocean. And that is the view outside my the house where I'm living currently. So it all kind of fitted together very nicely to kind of bring these paintings together in a... in that kind of way, I suppose.
Yes, because I think when we spoke to you last a few years ago, I think it was just after maybe COVID, and you had, there were Dodder paintings of the River Dodder, which is here in Dublin, obviously. And then you had paintings of the North Mayo coastline. So now I see there are exhibitions of Fionnuala and all along, really, the West Coast.
Yeah. I mean, it is, I suppose, embracing my travelling down the coast of Ireland as far as West Cork and of course, County Clare. I think it's just really, it's about the collection of paintings rather than specifically about, say, one particular part of Ireland. So, yes.
And the poems, I suppose, talk about the river going into the ocean. It's about transformation. And I think when people look at your paintings, they think of the landscape that you're painting, but they also, the paintings draw people in to into the scene. Is it in some way, are you hoping that they will have, do you ever think about the effects your paintings will have on them? Or is that just something that you wait to see what happens?
I make the paintings. I guess I'm very happy that people respond to them in all manner of ways. You know, I think... you know, I don't think about, I suppose, the audience or viewers' response to them necessarily. It's very much about how I feel about the process of painting and what the paint does for me in the process of making that work, whether I'm out in the landscape. And sometimes I am. I do work outdoors sometimes. That in itself is an experience which I think is hard to replicate sometimes when you're in the studio. But I am very more a studio-based painter in that I develop larger scale paintings in the studio, which I couldn't do outdoors.
In the landscape then, sometimes you would sketch or sometimes you would take photographs, is that right? And then work on the bigger painting back in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of all of those. I mean, over the years, and I suppose my experience of, say, Mayo has been, I've been coming here for nearly 30 years. And my painting career is kind of based on my experience in working in the landscape in the north coast of Mayo. So in a way, it's wonderful to be living now in the west of Ireland and experiencing that. So I think it's going to have an effect that maybe just being the occasional visitor to the west, as I've been for the last 30 years, although being on residency, I mean, there's no, you know, being on a residency in the west of Ireland is an absolutely amazing opportunity always to develop your work and to move forward with work. So I think working here in the landscape will certainly have a change, will bring about a change in the work, maybe deepen an emotional engagement with the landscape as well. I think that happens anyway, and I hope that will project in the work and affect also how people view the work ultimately.
And now many of your seascapes are inspired, as we said, by the Atlantic Ocean at Mayo, but you've also included some paintings from Cork and Clare in this exhibition, which we will tweet out now at RTE Arena. What's it about, that constant motion of the ocean waves in these works?
I think it's, I guess I've always been drawn to movement. Movement and light, and you know that the dynamic nature of the west coast of Ireland, the elemental properties that feature. I there's always seems to be an element of movement in the work, even though I often wish I could just capture stillness sometimes very well too. I do attempt that. I think the river paintings were an attempt to. And to capture the quietness within an urban setting, the contrast that being in this suburban river parkland came. So the rivers, in a way, the river bank paintings were very much a contrast or a complementary way of looking at landscape compared to the west coast of Ireland and its rocky landscape and crashing waves and change of light.
I know in your seascapes you use
different implements almost, you know, DIY implements like trowels and heavier implements. Is there a difference in the way you do your paintings of the rivers as opposed to the seascapes?
There might be. I don't know. Yes, I probably use a lot more brushes when I'm painting those broadleaf plants and the various things. But I've become very accustomed to using alternative trowels and, you know, tools, I suppose, when painting. So in a way, I find it, you know, I seem to have kind of adopted a trowel as a way of painting that I can apply to almost anything in a way. But at the same time, I'm always conscious that that I must avoid any attempt, any sort of gimmickry or obvious sort of, you know, impasto techniques that stand out too much. You know, my tools are used to the best of my ability to make it look as though I'm not using tools at all or using trowels, you know. Sometimes they can look like brushes. The scumbling that affects dragging paint across the surface is all part of the process. It's almost like building in nature, a natural world, building the rocks, the surfaces. And the same with the water surfaces as well. You know, it's I found the techniques over many years of working with these tools. So, yeah, it's...
Yes, because it's interesting that you are talking now about a river and a river entering an ocean or entering a sea, because in a lot of the past work, it's that idea of the shoreline being battered by the sea or the connection point between the sea and the rockscape.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think... Again, it comes back to the particular location where I am, where this amazing transition of the estuary into the sea occurs. A combination of sandbanks and low tide. And the title of the show at the Clare Morris Gallery is called Away from the Hill, A Wave from the Hill. Mm-hmm. And that refers to a little wave that appears out on the sea at a particular time when the tide is either on its way in or on its way out as it hits a submerged land bank. And so this is in this kind of quiet estuary panoramic view, this one single wave keeps recurring. And it's and so that, to me, it kind of stood out as some sort of metaphor. I'm not quite sure, but, you know, it kind of gave me a reason to bring these paintings together, I think, in some way. But I leave that open to interpretation anyway.
Of course. Well, my thanks to Donald Teskey. His latest exhibition, as he says, Away from the Hill, will be at the Clare Morris Gallery from March the 22nd to April the 19th. More details on claremorrisgallery.ie.